Okay, thanks once again. On to our next session, Accelerating Profitability, Achieving a Competitive Edge Through Rapid Scorecard Development. Our speakers are Praveen Bura and Melanie Berenhorst. Praveen Bura, as a founder and director of Analytics Engine, Praveen brings over 30 years of analytics expertise. A qualified actuary with a degree in actuarial science from the London School of Economics, Praveen has pursued advanced certifications in data analytics and risk management, including FASA, FIA, Sierra, and FRM. Previously, Praveen was a partner at Deloitte South Africa, where he established and led the bank analytics practice. He also served as the head of customer analytics at Standard Bank. Praveen is passionate about helping organizations use data to make better decisions and has extensive experience in both credit risk and customer analytics. Praveen's commitment to effective model governance emphasizes the importance of using models as essential tools in decision making while recognizing their limitations. Melanie Berenhorst. Melanie is a credit data scientist at Analytics Engine and holds a master's degree in business mathematics and informatics, an honors in quantitative risk management, and a BSc in actuarial sciences. She is also a PRM candidate. With extensive experience across various industries, she has specialized in scoring and impairment modeling. As the product owner for the Analytics Engine Scorecard Engine, she has successfully reviewed and built multiple credit scorecard models, contributing to optimizing lending practices across application, collection, and retention scoring. She is passionate about data science, statistics, actuarial science, and quantitative risk management, and enjoys practically applying these principles to solve real-world problems. Please help me welcome Praveen and Melanie.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. If there's one thing we take away from the previous speaker, I just want to call out, I think, one of the cleverest things I heard here today, which is he said, we do things from first principles. And I think if ever there's a tagline you take away from staying out of trouble, it's, I do things from first principles. So thank you to the previous speaker for that. I think the simpler, the better. Less things can go bump. Okay, so today we're going to talk to you about how you win. How do you achieve profit more faster? How do you grow faster? And it comes back to what the previous speaker said. How do we do first principles? We're going to talk a lot about credit scoring, and because credit scoring and pricing go together, we'll touch on both, even though our topic just says credit scoring. One of the things you probably all learned at university, it's not how risky someone is, but how much you can charge relative to that risk, obviously subject to the NCA and a few other things in the fine print. Okay. Perfect. So before we start, we thought we'd ask a few questions. So you can ask us questions in the end, we'll ask them to start. So when we think about winning and when we think about making a successful business, what are the questions we need to answer? And so on the board, we ask a few general questions, and answering these questions probably go to your organization's maturity, if I call it that, in terms of its ability to win. And I'll come back to what I mean by winning shortly. So let's quickly go through one or two of those questions. I'm not going to read all of them. But the first one is, where do you want to win? One of the things we've all seen the Olympics recently, and what you'll see is, no one athlete can win in everything. You've got to choose your sport. You've got to choose your lane. We can't win everywhere. So where do we really want to win? And if we don't know where we want to win, then how do we train? So one of the first questions to ask is, where do you want to win? Which customer segment, which channel, which product? And that's a good place to start. The second one is, are you proactively listening? And I'll come back later to what I mean by proactively listening. But the one thing we know for sure about the world is that things go bump. COVID happens. Load shedding happens. So if you're not actively listening, if you're going with the flow, if I could put it that way, you're going to be slower to pick up that something has changed, and you're going to be slower to then decide what to do and then to respond. So active listening is what I call it. How good is your active listening? So we're all in the business of data and data science and models, but are we actually listening? I don't think I'm going to go through the rest of that. You've all had enough time to read it, or it'll come through in the slides. So if you move through to the next one.
Okay. So going back to principles, basically our first principles, as Praveen said, we're going to take a bit of a step back. So now that you've seen all of these questions, let's just think about what we are trying to do and what the purpose is of a bank. So if you just think about it, in essence, all a bank is, it's a business and it wants to make a profit, right? So the banks lend money to individuals and businesses, and this is risky because typically you get customers that don't pay back, and that means the business makes a loss, which means the business closes. So what do we do as risk practitioners? Well, we manage and assess this risk. And one of the ways we do this is using credit scorecards. So what is a credit scorecard? Well, in essence, a credit scorecard is merely the tool that you use to assess risk. It evaluates the credit worthiness of a potential borrower and assigns a credit score to that borrower. Now you might ask yourself, what is this credit score? Because people talk about credit scores and why is this thing important and why don't we just use the predicted probability? Well, a credit score, in essence, and I'm going to read from the slide now, is used to communicate the quality or riskiness of a potential borrower in a simplified manner, making it easy for other people to understand. And it's based on the past performance of similar customers. So now I want to highlight specifically those two in red. So obviously it's a model. And when we think about these scores, we need to think about what we mean with similar customers. So how do I make sure that I give the right score to the right customer? And what past performance am I using? Did I look at the past economic cycles? Did I look at things like our elections? Did I take everything into account when I generated those scores? So looking at the origination process, first off, we need to understand and know our customers. So we need to get the information from that customer. After we've done that, we need to determine if that customer can afford this loan or product that we're giving them. So can they repay that loan? Then we do credit scoring, which helps us to assign that risk grade or score that we just talked about. Then we can decide, well, what are we going to charge this customer based on that risk grade that we gave them? And what's the limit and the terms going to be? Then finally, we can decide, well, do we want to include this customer in our strategy? Well, is it within our business strategy and our risk appetite to actually include this customer? Then finally, if we approve this customer, we can disperse the loan and onboard that customer. So what's the operational benefits of scoring? Well, and I think it was hinted on in the previous sessions as well, it allows us to do faster time to decisioning, because in the past it was something that was done manually, but now it's an automated process and there's no bias. So it's consistent in that sense if you apply the correct judgment and customers are treated fairly. It's also scalable across the business because now you have a risk range that you can use in multiple places in your business and not just in one place. And it's also easy to communicate to people. It's also cost-saving in the sense that it's automated, so no need to sit in that room full of documents as they mentioned previously. So as we talked about now, scorecards are essentially used to rank customers. So what does this mean? And well, it means, well, we can determine how risky a customer is, but can we determine by how much? And when is it optimal to decide when a customer is good or bad or excellent, as shown in this picture? Well, the way to do that is by determining a scorecard cutoff. And this is always a very, I guess, sensitive topic depending on what business wants to do. So typically, they would either want to be conservative. So from a risk perspective, you obviously don't want any defaults in your book, and that would be awesome. Unfortunately, if you have no defaults or if you have so few customers that you know will pay back, you will most probably not make a profit. The other part of the story is you want to increase your market share and you want to win business. So, but that means you need to adjust that cutoff and include more risky customers into your portfolio. And that's also difficult to do because that means now if you don't have the right combination, you probably won't make a profit. So what do you want? You want something where your credit risk premium essentially exceeds your cost of credit. So where a risk is less than what it costs to get those customers on book. Okay, so the question then becomes is how do we do this? Well, the answer to this is essentially risk-based pricing, as Praveen mentioned. So maybe just to talk to the graph a bit, typically you'd have this more bell curve where the blue bars would represent your customers, and you would have your credit score at the bottom representing the score that the scorecard is assigned to it, and then you have your red line which represents your bad rate. And this makes sense if you look at the graph. Customers with a lower score typically have a higher default rate, where customers with a higher score have a low default rate. So what was done in the past? In the past, typically banks would price on average. So for all of these customers, they would sell the same price. And this made sense in the past. However, so this made sense in the past because it was easy to implement operationally, and it was also something that all of the other banks in the industry did. So, however, that means this is not a very optimal way to do it. So, why do I say that? Because if you just look at this, right, on the right-hand side, what happens now is, well, business, good customers would typically be priced too expensively, so those customers won't be able, well, probably go to other banks, especially today, where the banks are much more competitive than they were in the past. And that means the bank will typically lose their good customers. Whilst on the left-hand side, you're pricing too cheaply for your bad customers, which means you attract bad risks, because now that customer would rather go to your bank than maybe an F&B, because that would mean you lose. Okay, so yeah, so they come to your bank, and that would mean you get all the bad customers. And just imagine what that portfolio would look like. That's bad. So, what's the solution to this, right? So, how do we fix this problem to ensure that we actually have good customers and we manage the risk on the bad side? Well, that's where the risk-based pricing comes in, or segmentation. So instead of asking an average price to all your customers, have a price that's set for a specific customer group. So now, in this case, you have a good price for your good customers, and those customers would come to your bank, and that's because they would get a better price than maybe at an F&B. So, yeah, and where your bad customers would typically rather go to another bank, because they would only get probably get a better price at those banks, which means your risk in your book decreases. But now you can tell me, well, Milani, we already do this at banks. We do segment and we do risk-based pricing. And typically, when we talk about that, as mentioned previously, it's done on things like age and salary. Well, looking at this example, assume you have a neighbor, and that neighbor has two twin sons. And these two twin sons both are dentists, and they have the same annual income. But let's assume they're called Yaku and Davi. So Yaku has a wife and two children, while Davi is a bachelor and still enjoying this single life and having fun. So yeah, that's nice. So they have the same age and salary, but they don't have the same disposable income. And this is where the difference comes in, right? So Davi would probably have more disposable cash at hand, and he would typically maybe spend more money, like buying a fancy bachelor pad or a fancy car. And he probably won't need a larger house if he has his bachelor flat, so he won't buy a large house in the near future. Whilst Yaku might be regarded as a more stable customer because he's married. And he would have less disposable cash because he has to pay for his children's school fees and ensure his family is fed. And probably if he's renting now, he will want to upgrade to a larger house in the near future if they're going to grow their family. So what am I trying to say with this? So it's good to consider things like age and income, but for you to really get a gain, you need to actually understand your customer base, right? So you need to understand what's the needs within your customer base, and you need to segment according to that. But now again, the problem comes in. This means it's more work in terms of doing feature engineering and doing proper segmentation. So how do we solve for this? So there are a lot of common issues in terms of scoring. I think we've all experienced a lot of these, especially when you go to audit, and maybe when you're validating models or building models, especially that unrealistic expectation part of it. But instead of focusing on all of these, I think our session is about how do we achieve that competitive edge and how do we win. And yeah, so I'm going to give over to Praveen to give you the speech on how we win.
Thanks, Melanie. Speaking about auditors, someone earlier today asked, what's a random number? And a random number is one your auditor doesn't like. Okay, so we talk about winning, but what do we actually mean by winning? Because winning, well, it's different for different people have different views of winning. So I tried to define what winning means for me if I was a bank. The first one is every bank has its strategy and has its goals and has its aspirations. And if you're achieving those things, you're winning. If you're not achieving those things, you're not winning. A little earlier, someone spoke about developmental finance, and one of the goals was to fund farmers, put people in houses. If you're not doing those things, then you're not winning. So winning varies from company to company, but fundamentally it's about achieving your strategy. The second one is outperforming your competition. We don't know that COVID's around the corner. We don't know that load shedding or tomorrow water shedding is around the corner. But when it comes, we want to beat our peers. So outperformance of peers in a good cycle, more growth. In a bad cycle, less losses. As the cycle turns, a faster response. That's outperforming our peers. So that's winning. The next one is trust with your customers. So it's all well and good to say it's great to have a machine learning model for fraud because we can't copy it and tell the fraudsters what it is because we don't know ourselves. But when you're approving someone for a loan or not approving someone for a loan, then are we happy or do we want them to understand why they've been approved or not approved? If they can understand why they can get approved or not get approved, then at least they know what to do to A, ask for a smaller loan, or to bridge the gap to get the loan they really want. So transparency matters, and building trust with our customers is critical. And then the last one, regardless of what happens, are we slow or are we fast? What is our cadence of response? If we can respond fast, we win. So when we come to the question section later, if any of you think of anything else I can add to the slide, that would be good. Then I can use it again next year. okay, so how do you win? And these are five steps that I've put down. The first one is curate your data, because we all spend too much time looking for, waiting for, trying to get, or throwing away the data because we don't like it. So curating your data means having the data you want available when you want it. It doesn't happen by accident. All of us in this room love building models, but if we don't want to curate the data or hire someone else to curate the data for us and guide them as to what we mean by the data we want, well, how do we plan to expect it to happen? The second is through active listening, and I alluded to this earlier. We in the data game, but how much time do we spend building models versus listening to the data? What is it actually telling us? So active listening is critical. Choosing your tools, and we love tools. I work for a company where everybody loves building models. We love machine learning. We love toys. But you've got to choose your tools wisely. And then building your team. Leanne this morning mentioned that all of this can't sit on one person's shoulders. We need a team to get this done. And especially when things come to crunch time. If you have a team, you can divide and conquer, you can respond and not crack under pressure. So building your team is critical. And then finally, managing your workflow. And again, I like, do it from first principles, do it as simple as you can, and do it as fast as you can, and automate it. If you can get those things right, you can win. It doesn't matter whether you're using a simple model, a statistical model, a simple rule set, which is an expert judgment, or a fancy neural net. At the end of the day, if you're not doing these things, something's going to break someday. And if you do all of these things, something might still break, but the chances are a lot less. Okay, so let's come back to the twins. When we say curate the data, what do we mean? And what are the obvious things that we should do? The first one is a single view of a customer. So typically in a large bank, you've got lots of different admin systems. You've got a separate admin system for motor, you've got a separate admin system for personal loans, a separate admin system for credit card. Now most of the banks sell insurance, so you've got a separate system for that. So when a customer does something on one system, you don't know about it in the other systems. So the first thing you've got to do is get all of the data together. And especially today with compute power being what it is, there's no excuse. It's purely a question of will. And you'll note specifically I've called it a single view of customer value. What of that data matters to you? You can't get everything about everyone. There's just not enough hours in the day. But choosing what data you want around risk and value specifically and behavior and desire of the customer, what he wants or she wants, is critical. So the first thing is get the single view of customer value. The second one is the feature library, especially from a credit scoring perspective. If you're going to understand the customer, whether it's for fraud or to lend him something, or to design your new bundle of one fee bank account, if I call it that, you need features about the customer. Yes, their age is the same. Yes, their salaries, they are the same. But their lifestyles are definitely not the same. Their ability to finance their lifestyles is not exactly the same. And the only way you're going to get that is by a conscious, continuous effort to listen and to invest in listening. And that's critical. So you've got to be consistently looking to create new features about your customers and very importantly, putting them into production. What we've seen in general with banks is they're quite good at creating features. They're also quite good at recreating those features 3 years later. And the reason is because they didn't document which features worked and didn't work. So when someone redoes the work in 3 years' time, they can't learn from the lessons of the past. And if it's not in production, then, well, it's not available today, and I don't even know that it exists because banks are such large places. Customer segmentation. How do you segment customers? And often it's done by simple things like risk score and age and income. But then you're missing things like one's married and one's not. One owns a bachelor pad and one wants to buy a big house. And we can't know everything, right? We don't know what people really want, but we can observe their behavior and we can observe their lifestyle if we're listening and if we're trying to listen. And then the last thing, very importantly, is the regular refresh. All of this should be updated as frequently as is possible. So that it's pointless building this today and leaving it, because in 2 years' time it's out of date. So it's got to update. It's got to refresh. The next one is active listening. So currently in most banks, we do two things very well. We do model validation, and we do portfolio management or monitoring. And they're two separate steps. And why are they two separate steps? What do you do in monthly monitoring of a portfolio that you don't do in validation? And what do you do in validation that you don't do in portfolio monitoring? And in my head, portfolio monitoring is continuous validation. It's validation of your model, it's validation of your business model, and it's validation of your ability to run your business. But it's continuous. And so the big question we've got to ask is, why do we have these two silos of model validation and monitoring? And how do we bring them together so that we can continuously do both? When we're monitoring a typical portfolio, there's sort of two main areas. The first one is the front book. And by the front book, we mean the loans, the customers that are coming to you, so the people you want to offer credit to. How are they changing? What's changed? What's changed today versus 5 years ago when we built our scorecard? Let's say you're doing a motor book. The motor sales in South Africa are slightly down, but the mix of vehicles in South Africa has totally changed. So how does that affect our scorecard? How does that affect our pricing for these loans? So watching what comes through your front door matters. It matters what percentage of the market you think you're getting. It matters which segment of customers are coming to you for what type of deal, and it matters how that's changing. So all the usual population stability measures, etc. So the three typical things we'd look at in the front book is the stability of the population. The second one is the market share. How is your market share changing? Who's sending you deals and who's not? And the response rate, when you make the offer to the customer, which customers take you up on it and which customers don't. That's a good lead indicator of where you fit in the market. Because if a lot of customers in a particular segment are leaving you, is your risk-based pricing right, or have one of your peers got it wrong? Okay, then we look at the back book. The back book is after you've issued the loan. What happens? Well, there's three things that we're very interested in. The first one is our ranking. Can we tell a good customer from a bad customer? The only time we'll know is after we've issued the loan, right? We can guess with a high degree of statistical probability, but we'll only know for sure after we've issued the loans. So are the customers that we thought were going to default at 1% defaulting at 1%? The second one is the level. Even though we can tell who's a high-risk customer and a bad customer, is the level of default the same? Is that 1% not gone to 1.5% or 0.5%? When COVID hit, who went up and who went down and by how much? And could we understand what changed that caused that? So the level is also something we're quite interested in. And then just the A versus E, the actual versus expected. If we issued mortgages and we expected defaults to be the highest between, 6 months and 36 months, did that actually happen? And all of this matters because it tells us where in our decision-making process we can place reliance, what is good at prediction and what is not. So those are the two big things we're interested in, is monitoring is the front book and the back book. But then we're also interested in the macroeconomic modeling and the cycle, but also the politics, right? What happens now that we've got a GNU, sounds like a type of buck, government of national unity. How does it change things? You can't just look at your internal data, you have to look outside, right? What's happening? Because what's happening matters. So you have to look at the macroeconomic variables, you have to look at the politics, and you have to look at lead indicators and what people are saying in the community. The next and the last one then is trend analysis and triggers. And trend analysis and triggers, again, should be continuously available to you. You shouldn't have to go and create it. I mean, given we need it all the time, why is it not on tap? So trend analysis should be there. And very importantly, once you have trend analysis, you should over time be able to figure out what is an acceptable or normal range of a trend so that you can create triggers to identify when something is outside of normal behavior. One of the problems we have today is not that we don't have active listening. Well, we have lots of passive listening. And the reason we don't have active listening is because there's too much and nobody can wade through all of it. So this is where the triggers become very important. But you can only do the triggers if you've done the trend analysis and first identified what is normal and what is not normal. Remember, the faster and the better you listen, the better you'll serve your customer, but also the quicker you'll know something is changing and something is happening. So if you want to respond fast, you need to know it's happening first, then you can evaluate it and then decide your response. Okay, choosing your tools is critical. When it comes to credit pricing and customers' credit scoring, there's two fundamental engines you need. You need a scorecard engine, which is an engine used to build your scorecard. It's a tool, an algorithm, a model that builds your scorecard. But you also need a decision engine, which is a workflow engine. And your decision engine allows you to take a customer, send him to the right scorecard, properly score him, and then look at the affordability for him, look at the collateral for him, and make an offer and generate that offer to the customer. If you're doing champion challenger scorecards, your decision engine will send a certain percentage of customers to your challenger scorecard. And then if you're happy to switch to your challenger scorecard, it should be as simple as flicking a switch so that you move from your old scorecard to your new scorecard. You'll often hear and see in banks that we can build a model in 6 months, validate it in 2 years, and implement it in five. It's nuts, right? Sorry, I'm using silly numbers. But the principle is correct, right? How do we do it faster? It's having a decision engine. So the two engines you have to have and think about is your scorecard engine, how quickly you can build a scorecard, and your decision engine, how quickly can you operationalize that scorecard. Case, some things to think about, and I'm going to read here because I can't remember them all. The first one is cadence. How fast can you build a scorecard? How fast can you change a scorecard in operations? That's the first one. The second one is a staff onboarding one, and we don't think about this often, but if you're building a complicated model, and it's not serious because not just she understands it, but everybody in that row understands it, which is all great, then you're not running key man risk until all three of them change business units at the same time. So key man risk matters. So when you're building your infrastructure, when you're choosing your tools, can we choose stuff that's simple? Or at least simple to understand and use. It doesn't have to be simple. It can be a fancy machine learning model like we saw this morning. Wonderful, happy with that. But can it be simple to understand and use? So when we say simple, it doesn't mean we're going to go back to using an abacus. It could be a neural net in the back. But is it simple to understand and use? Can it be a low-code or no-code tool or environment? And that matters a lot, right? My experience with most financial services companies is they have a lot of clever people. There are clever people on the floor. When you walk in a bank and you walk beyond the customer service areas, there's these huge floors of people sitting at desks. And most of them actually are quite clever. The problem is not all of them can do math like an actuary, code like a computer scientist, and understand the business like the CEO. But they all are very competent. So if we give them a no-code, low-code interface that's easy to understand and use, we can tap into all of that wasted talent. And I say it's wasted because we're not getting full productivity given how clever those people are, because I do believe that a lot of them are clever. The other one is governance. How do we manage this whole system? How do we check it? How do we have human in the loop? How do we stop silly things? Or how do we stop accidents? And we're never going to stop them all, but how do we minimize the chance of them? So everything needs to be understood philosophically or in principle. Everyone doesn't have to understand every step, but if you trust that the model builder is building the model properly, and you trust that the IT guys are going to implement it properly, and you trust that the business guy is going to not intentionally apply bias, then that system can work faster. So governance is about establishing trust, and your entire systems and controls need to be about establishing trust. You have to have buy-in. That, for me, is critical. It's the single biggest cause of failure. It's the single biggest complaint between finance and the actuarial teams or quant teams is, we've got these clever people, but they don't help me run the business better. And it's because of that trust between building that team dynamic between people. If they have buy-in internally as well as with your customers and your channel, then you're going to win. Doesn't matter how clever you are. If you don't have buy-in, you're dead. Go for it. as often as you need to is the short answer. There's the my personal view on a scorecard is minimum revaluation is at least once a year. Ideally, if you have active listening and active monitoring, it will tell you when things need to change. And basically, you need to change fundamentally two times. One is when it's not working or not working well enough, and the other is when you change your strategy. So you decide to go after a different micro segment or pull back in a micro segment.
Well, hard is you have to wait 12 months.
Yes. Correct. And that's why some of your listening, you'll have your vintage curves with you and some of your early indicators. But you can also calculate your continuous discrimination every month on the last couple months. But you're always going to have that lag, right? You're never going to get away from the lag. What worries me more is the fact that there's lots of lenders out there who update their scorecard every 3 years, which for me is just plain scary. Okay. Then... cool. Building your team, again, and in your team, you need, as a minimum, finance, you need your quants, you need the people who prepare the data, you need IT, and you need people who talk to the customers. We often forget branch and channel. A couple of important things in building your team. If you're going to build trust and you're going to build relationships between back office and front office, you need to have discussions. If you're not talking to each other, if you're not challenging each other, if you're not actively considering the input from each other, because before you build a scorecard, what we often do is we'll go to a data warehouse, we'll pull the data, chuck it in our model, and out comes an answer. I recommend that. But what I do recommend also is one step before that, all the people with hair like my color, the gray hair, can we pull them into a room and ask them, like in the past, what do you think makes a good customer? Often these people know it, right? They've got a model in their head, they just haven't formalized it. There's a lot of knowledge in institutions, there's a lot of knowledge in channels, there's a lot of knowledge in branch. We've got to be able to talk to each other and say, I think the following, can we investigate? And the problem with a lot of organizations is A, we don't have the conversation, and B, we don't have the bandwidth to have those investigations. So if we want to win again, we've got to A, stop those conversations, and B, have the bandwidth. We've also got to be realistic. We can't test everything. We've got to prioritize. And we're never going to build the best model the first time. We've got to iterate, and we've got to iterate fast. We've got to learn fast. We've got to investigate fast. So in the environment we're building, the faster we can do those, the more we can test. Everybody talks about new data now. I want to test telco data. I want to test social media data. I want to test supermarket data. Oh, great. How fast can you do it? When you find, I don't know, let's not use F&B as an example now. People who use Checkers and then Pick and Pay and then Woolworths, and we now have know which customers shop where. Is it better if we build one scorecard with those being a flag, or is it better if we build three separate scorecards? And the easiest way to answer that is to just do it. But if it takes us 6 months to do each one, we're not going to do it. So speed and cadence matter. And then the last one, no bias from my part, there is partner with external parties. In theory, they bring skills and expertise. They bring capacity, and capacity matters, right? We may not need capacity now, but when there's three people in the front row change departments, then you need capacity. When the auditors ask silly questions, you need capacity. When a shock hits the system, you need capacity. So plan for that capacity. And then continuity again, right? When people leave, suddenly you have to re-engineer because you lose that institutional knowledge. If you've got good consultants, then you retain some of that. And then they bring a different perspective, hopefully, right? If you're having the conversations. If you just tell them, build this model, they build the model. But if you actually have the conversations, hopefully they're one step removed from your day-to-day pressures and then ask stupid questions. Stupid questions are a wonderful thing. Okay, and then manage your workflow. And interestingly, I was just saying, within our company, we have a philosophy around the way we approach problems, and we call it internally GAS. Generalize, automate, and simplify. So everything we do, we want to do as simply as we can. We want to generalize it so that we can use it for more than one application. So can we build it like a set of Lego blocks so we can use it again? And can we automate it so we can play with it fast? So again, if we had the data set which had the supermarkets that people shop at, and could we could quickly filter and say, quickly filter by Woolworths customers, and then run them through the model and see the answer. Quickly filter by Pick and Pay customers, run them through the model and see the answer. Then it becomes viable to build three separate models quickly. But if your process is manual, then that's not happening. Very importantly, the second bullet there, human in the loop, it matters a lot. Your cadence of process matters a lot. Your cadence of changing the process matters as much. And transparency, do we trust it? We don't have to understand every step in it, but do we trust it? Is it clear? If when you're building your scorecard, you're choosing your variables on this wonderful thing called an information value, business is not going to understand that. But if you show them the bins that you've built and the difference in the bad rate by the bins, they can understand that. So everything comes down to communication. And that communication builds transparency and builds trust. Okay. So, before to summarize those, A, curate your data. So we come back to those twins. How do we create more features about the twins so that we know one is married and one is not? Regularly refresh that, because if you don't regularly refresh that, it's not going to be useful. Active listening. Think about monitoring as continuous validation. Create your trends automatically. Create your triggers. Think about your tools, specifically your scorecard engine and your decision engine. Cadence of transparency, and reduction of key man risk. And then simplify, automate, and interpret. Iterate. Okay, so that if we do these things, which sound pretty straightforward, we actually can go a lot faster. I'm going to show you a quick video. I'm going to apologize in advance. It is an advertising video, but I'll talk a few comments as to why it comes to this, if you don't mind.
Introducing the Scorecard Engine from Analytics Engine, our automated solution for building scorecards. Have you ever found the process of creating a scorecard long and complex? Did you achieve the competitive business advantage that you desired? With the Scorecard Engine, you can significantly enhance your competitive advantage. Our tool allows you to swiftly explore and incorporate new data, thanks to its automated binning and feature selection capabilities. What used to take weeks can now be accomplished in minutes. Building scorecards has never been easier. Our point-and-click interface eliminates the need for coding. This reduces key man risk and the time to upskill new employees. The intuitive menu bar ensures a hassle-free experience. As data scientists, we love creating models, but documentation can be a challenge. Our solution: automated documentation. Say goodbye to black box models. Our transparent documentation includes all the necessary graphs and metrics for model validation. With just one click, you can download comprehensive Excel and Word files, making submissions for governance and management reporting effortless. If you're serious about outsmarting your competition, let Analytics Engine assist you. Our scorecard engine is automated, user-friendly, and transparent, providing the competitive advantage you've been seeking.
So, other than the no free lunch here to sit through a minute of an advert, I just want to talk about how we got there. So when we started Analytics Engine, we wanted to automate models for businesses, and I didn't think there was a market in building scorecards, and they kind of found us. And so we started building it, and we found that the process of building scorecards was the same. So we identified a common thing that we do often. We automated that common thing. And then playing this back versus what we see here on the slide, what have been our learnings from this? The first thing is, A, if the client's got that, once the data is ready, so you've got to decide where each tool starts and finishes. Once the data is prepared, and you always have to prepare the data, so there's no shortcuts there, although if you curate it, you only prepare it once. once the data is prepared, if we can run the model quickly, we can run lots of models. So if we want to run, again, I use the example of pick and pay versus checkers. If you can have your data prepared once, run a filter that separates just one customer segment, chuck it in the model, an hour later we've got a scorecard. Chuck the other one in, an hour later we've got a scorecard. Leave both in, we've got a scorecard. Compare the answer, does splitting give you more lift or not? We've got the answer. So we can do things now very quickly versus slower. How does that help us? As a business, we go to a bank outside of South Africa because we're trying to win work internationally, and we say, we're good at building scorecards. They don't know us. But because we've got a tool that builds it quickly and cheaply, I can now, as a POC, rebuild a scorecard they've built before. And I often like that because I don't want to build them a new scorecard for free. But the last time they built a scorecard, they've already done the data prep, so they've got the data. So they can give us the data. We can run it through our tool because, on average, it's taking us 1 hour to run the scorecard. And then I've got an answer that they can compare with their previous scorecard. So suddenly my business can now test more things quickly and prove value more quickly. So that's a big advantage for us. The other thing which we didn't factor as a big benefit which hit us is because we've got a simple front end, and you can do this with any of your things. I'm not necessarily selling this tool, but I am if anyone's interested. because you've got a simple point and click front end, we had a case where a client gave us a data set. Melanie and I were both running around to a whole bunch of other meetings, and we asked one of our juniors to just load the data and just run it through and let's see what comes out. And in 3 hours, it's the first time in her life she ever built a scorecard. In 3 hours, she had an answer that was better than the client's original answer. And that's when it hit us that there's actually a huge labor time saving in terms of training. And that matters, because especially when we have the high rate of staff churn that we do, that matters a lot. So that was the second thing that hit us. And then the last one was just the transparency, right? Outputting the graphs that just show the bins and the bad rate per bins. Business can relate to that and understand that. They don't have to understand all the maths, but they can say, if you're using age, we can see, and if you're a motor insurer as an example, we can see that youngsters have more accidents than older people. And you can see it on the graph, and therefore it makes sense that age is a rating factor in a motor insurance model. So not everyone has to understand what an information value is, but if they see a variable split into bins, young people, old people, high accidents, low accidents, they can relate to that. And then you build trust and have good conversations. That's all I really want to say. Happy to jump to questions. Go for it.
Hi. In the first step, you spoke about we need to understand the customer. So yes. Hence, that means collecting information and creating what you call customer segmentation. But isn't there a risk? Isn't there a trade-off between customer segmentation and producing reliable customer scorecards? Because the more information you collect, the finer the segments. And can you produce like accurate and reliable customer scorecards from those fine segments? So small size segments. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. So two parts to that question. The first one is the three things that we recommend in terms of listening to the customer is the single view of customer value, which tells you which customer, how the customer matters to you in terms of how he's banking with you and how much money he's working for you, etc. So that's the first part. I like putting all of these results into SQL so that you can always just put it into Power BI or ClickView or Tableau or whatever you use, and then you can change your view about how you slice them in the different views. The important thing is it doesn't matter what segments you have today. Tomorrow they'll be different. So you want to be able to just add a new column with a new segment flag and rerun all your models, and that's important. In terms of your question about, yes, if you drill down too much, you'll have too much volatility, that is correct. Fortunately, that's not a problem for large retail banks in most cases, in 80% of cases. 20% of cases, absolutely. So in your business banking, maybe, in your relationship banking, maybe. But for your mass market, your full middle class, you can actually build probably 10 times more segments than you have today, and you've still got enough customers. So that, for me, I think is interesting. Interestingly, I've been a big fan of unsupervised segmentation for a long time, and what I've often found is you do it, you sleep on it, you write a storyline about each segment, and after 2 weeks you'll change it, and after 6 months you'll change it again, and that's all a wonderful thing because the benefit is in you interrogating the data and thinking about the data. When I actually worked in a bank, we started off by running unsupervised segmentation and we came up with about 20 clusters that mattered. By the end of the following year, I think we had like 200 microsegments. Again, some of them, like you say, we wouldn't know what to do with them. But a lot of the segments, you can think of an operational reason of how you can improve your service to them or better price them or better risk manage them. So it's a journey. And again, this is why you have human in the loop, right? So when the segment gets too small, you stop segmenting. Any other questions?
Thanks, Praveen. I'm interested how you integrate with the banks to get the data. Is it through an API or CSV, file drop?
Yeah. So there's, again, coming back to the two engines, the engine to build the scorecard and the engine to use the scorecard. The engine to build the scorecard actually uses the whole history of past lending. So you end up with one row per customer. So that data set typically has like 100,000 rows in it. So that doesn't lend itself to an API call. Typically, the bank would give us a partition on their server, and we would then run the model on that server. So typically, we would ship our model, basically just copy it as a binary executable onto their server, and then run it on their server. And we can run on, typically, doesn't matter what architecture the client's running on. So we typically run on-premise. Also, the way the banks contract with us, they'll sue us for anything we lose or damage, so I don't want to take it. So I prefer running it on their server. For a lot of the second-tier clients and smaller clients and clients who are not banks, they're happy to give us data, and then we'll just hash or anonymize the data before we take away the data. So that we never ever take away anything that's POPIA related. Any other questions? Okay, perfect. Thank you.